Good morning. This is hour number two of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. The Little Bighorn Battlefield is the site of one of America's most famous armed struggles. It is also one of the most controversial attractions in the American West. This morning, in this hour of the show, we'll consider some of the complex issues surrounding the site and the way that federal officials, particularly people working in the Park Service, have tried to steer a course between providing access to people who want to go and see the battlefield, and at the same time preserve the integrity of an historical resource. We'll also talk about some of the controversy surrounding the recognition of the native peoples who fought there. And our guest for the program is Jerome Green. He is retired as research historian for the National Park Service, is author of a number of books about the West, and is the author of a newly published book, which is titled Stricken Field, The Little Bighorn Since 1876. It's published by the University of Oklahoma Press. Questions as we talk are welcome, of course. We only ask that people just try to be brief in their comments so that we can keep moving along and getting as many people as possible. But, of course, people who are listening are welcome to call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. And also, we do have that toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455 at any point. If you would like to call, the call and your questions and comments will be welcome. Mr. Green, hello.
Well, good morning, David. It's nice to be with you.
Well, we appreciate you giving us some of your time. You write in the book that nowhere have issues of public use versus preservation been more dramatic than at this place. Maybe we could talk just a little bit in a general way about that to start.
Certainly. The focus of that comment is really on the size of the park up there, which is a little more than a square mile, almost a postage stamp on the landscape. And, of course, has been buffeted for decades now by visitors, and the visitation continues to rise. And it's threatened by development not only from without, but also from within, as the Park Service tries to accommodate an increased visitation year after year.
Yeah, it's worth noting that as you do just what a small area this is. We're talking an acre. That's basically the size of a football field. That's not very big at all.
Well, no, this is a square mile.
Oh, I'm sorry, a square mile.
Yes.
It's a square.
More than, actually, it's 640 acres in that one track, and then there's another track about 3.5 miles to the south that's 160 acres.
Okay, so that's it. Well, okay, we're talking about several hundred acres. Well, at the same time, that's still, I suppose, you know, given the kind of landscape that we're talking out there, that's still a small, in a large open area, it's not a very big area.
It's not a very big area, and excuse me, through the years, a lot of development has occurred there. In the book, it's all discussed, but for example, the Visitor Center, which is a fairly large building, but small for its needs, really, but it's right on the resource itself, right below the area of the last stand, the so-called last stand, where Custer and the dregs of his command were wiped out in 1876.
So how soon after the battle did people start to go just to see the place?
Well, of course, in 1876, that was a very remote country, and there weren't many people other than the tribesmen, the Lakotas and the Cheyennes and Crow people and Arapahoes who normally lived in that general region would visit occasionally. But as the years went on, ranchers, drovers, others passing through would stop in and note the condition of the field. After the Battle of the Little Bighorn, the relief troops who turned up buried the dead, and of course, for several years thereafter, those remains just lay there on the terrain and went into the soil, and visitors would see these remains sticking out, projecting arms, legs, so forth through the years, and it took a while, even though it was declared a national cemetery in 1879, just 3 years later. It still was a sight to behold for anybody passing through, and it really was quite a few years before the remains, by that time were all picked up and put in a large grave at the base of this monolithic monument that is on top of the ridge there. I don't know if you've ever been to that site or not.
I have not. I know it only based on photographs that I've seen, like those that are in the book. So, no, I have never visited.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, the officers' remains were removed about a year after the battle. And, of course, that created some discomfiture for the families of the enlisted men. And so there arose a cry that they all remained together in some regard, and that ultimately led to the creation of the National Cemetery there in 1879.
Although Custer's, his remains are not there.
His remains are at West Point. His widow requested that his remains be sent to West Point, although there is some question as to whether or not they actually got Custer's remains at West Point.
Mm-hmm. So, as you say, initially the soldiers that were killed there, they were buried where they were found.
They were buried where their remains were found.
Where they were found.
That's right, and presumably that's where they fell in the action. Although they could have been dragged around after the fight too.
And then at some point then later, they were reburied, all buried together in more of a conventional cemetery kind of a...
Yes, because of this problem, this ongoing problem, the dirt up there is very ashy and very sparse, and it was very difficult to cover these remains and keep them covered for any length of time. I mean, just a matter of weeks, it seems a good rainstorm would wash all that dirt away. Some were covered with sagebrush, and it was finally decided the army built a fort about 14 miles away, named it Fort Custer, and the troops and the commanding officer of that fort were charged with kind of minding the battlefield site, and they would go down periodically and collect the bones and try to cover the remains again. And finally, it was decided to put up a monument, and they built a grave, kind of a trough grave, around the base of this large granite memorial that they raised in 1881. And all the remains that could be found, that is, the bones by that time, were brought up to that trough grave and buried within it around the base of the monument.
And I suppose it was also true at this time and probably for a long time afterwards that people passing through who visited the place looked around. If they saw something that looked like it was left from the battle, a lot of people picked up things and took them away with them.
Oh, you bet. Yes, that's been going on all the way up into the 20th century. Of course, not human remains any longer, but certainly back in those days, people would pick up bones. I think there was I have a reference to somebody who mailed a bone in years and years later, decades later, from Oklahoma, of all places. It had ended up down there.
Yeah, and even the monument itself was not didn't escape the monument that was set up in 1881. Apparently, people actually chipped little pieces of it off to take away as souvenirs.
That's right. Yes, along the edges, the monument actually came in three big sections, so the people would chip pieces of the stone off to take with them. And later on, after 1890, they put in markers to signify where these bodies had been found all over the field. And, of course, the primary attraction was the area of the Last Stand up just below the big monument where Custer and his immediate party all fell or all died. And people would go in and chip away on those stones, and it necessitated a kind of constant replacement until they put fences, strong iron fences, around both the monument and the Last Stand grouping.
That cemetery also was used to bury soldiers who had been killed elsewhere in the West, so this became not just a cemetery for 7th Cavalry members, but for other soldiers as well.
Exactly, but a distinction has to be made. It was originally set up, the battlefield itself was set up, established as a national cemetery. But over the years, as a lot of these Western posts closed their doors, and for good, the cemeteries at those posts, they needed to concentrate them someplace. And so they began another cemetery within the broader national cemetery that I'm telling you about. Mm-hmm. And they would ship in the remains from these various other posts. And so what essentially happened was the beginning of another cemetery within the larger national cemetery that had been established, and that became the depository for those remains from around the West. And then it was later, in later years, veterans of the Spanish-American War who passed away, World War One, and even World War Two in Vietnam, all the way up to through Vietnam, have been buried there at this kind of little enclave cemetery within the battlefield proper. The battlefield at first, of course, being the national cemetery. Mm-hmm.
So how many American soldiers altogether are there?
I believe in the area of around 10,000.
No.
It's a closed cemetery. Only people with long-term reservations can be buried there today. And relatives of people who have passed away.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Jerome Green, is retired as research historian for the National Park Service. He is the author of a recently published book that looks at the history of the Little Bighorn Battlefield, not so much about the battle itself, although there is a section about that. It is more about what happened to it afterwards. The title of his book is Stricken Field, the Little Bighorn Since 1876. It's published by the University of Oklahoma Press. We do have a caller, and other people are welcome to call in, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. The caller here is in St. Charles on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
I used to work for the Park Service years ago. I retired about 12 years ago. And back then, it seemed to me they had a lot of problem with financial, as far as the budget is concerned, that they did not have enough money to take care of all these sites. Is that still true?
Well, I think money has been tight for several years across the government, as you know, because of the war and everything. But to some degree, yes. But every park has a budget, and I think they put in requests, and I'm sure they don't get the money that they would love to see allotted to their particular resource, but they get by, and money is always a problem, as you must know, being a former Park Service employee.
It was very tough trying to keep the maintenance end of it intact. We had a lot of vandalism. Unfortunately, I was out in Southern California, and that seems to be out in California in general, northern part. And it was a very high maintenance. It seemed like I was replacing the same signs over and over again within the same week. And, you know, you're talking about putting up, erecting fences up around some of these monuments. Between the developers and off-road enthusiasts, it's taken a toll. And I do believe on the Forest Service end of it, some of Angeles National Forest has been sold off because the maintenance aspect of it has gotten so extremely expensive out there that it's almost beneficial just to sell out to the county. But I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're right about maintenance. Maintenance is always a perennial problem in all of the park areas, and I know that Yellowstone, for example, has had a lot of problems getting sufficient funds to handle road maintenance and that sort of thing. And that's a big park compared to Little Bighorn.
Yeah, that's I don't know how I got tripped up so seriously at the beginning when we were talking about the size of the park, because actually it's more than 760 acres. Is that right?
Yes, it is. With the two basic tracks, the one track is called the Custer Battlefield, and of course that's the major area. That's a square mile bordering the east side of the Little Bighorn River, and the other is about 3.5 to 4 miles to the south, and that's called the Reno Benteen Defense Site, because this battle was spread out. There were two major contests, one at the south end, which was actually the start of the battle, and then the Custer end of the field, which was the conclusion of the battle. It's kind of troubling to realize that people going up there today actually arrive at the scene of the end of the fight. And so it's been kind of bedeviling for people and interpreters to explain what happened. That's been one of the bugaboos about this park and its layout, and the attempts to rectify the interpretation of the park, particularly as the battle action actually flowed from south to north. And so people coming into the park come in at the end, and then they're directed to go all the way south to actually begin their tour. And that's kind of hard for people to comprehend after they've been in the museum, which is the first thing they see.
Mm-hmm. When quite a long time, say from the mid-1880s until 1940, the site was administered by the War Department. And then in 1940, I believe, that it became the responsibilities of the Park Service. Did things in why did that change come about, and what did that change mean for the park?
Well, the change came about as a result of kind of an omnibus measure from the 1930s under FDR, when the War Department sites, all of War Department military parks and national cemeteries, as well as Department of Agricultural sites, particularly these ruins in the southwest, Forestry Service, so forth, administered. They were all brought together and placed in the charge of the National Park Service. And in 1940, Custer Battlefield, it was called Custer Battlefield National Monument at that time, and of course the name change became a big issue and was finally changed in the early 1990s to Little Bighorn Battlefield National Monument. The big change, as I say, came in 1940 when this park left the War Department administration and joined the administration of the National Park Service.
Mm-hmm. At what point did the idea that that there was a story to be told, and that people coming there were going to look for someone to tell them that story, and that became part of what the site was all about, not just preserving it, but also having it be something where there was a museum and there were people there to give tours, and that there was an kind of an educational component to all of this?
Well, it evolved. It evolved. Now, under the War Department, became more and more focused on the caretaking and administration of not the broad battlefield, which was the original National Cemetery, but more on this small 10-acre cemetery that evolved for the remains from all these outlying posts, army posts in the area. And so they were not as intent on presenting any kind of interpretation. There was not a lot of visitation up there in those days either, through the through World War One. However, as more and more as these little towns developed in the area and population grew, there became an interest. And of course, occasionally movies would come out that would excite national interest in this event, such as They Died with Their Boots On in the early 40s, and that triggered interest. Of course, it was at that point that the National Park Service had coincidentally come in and become the administrator of the site. And when that happened, the focus shifted from the cemetery, the smaller cemetery, to the battlefield as a whole, because there was more interest and more inquiries about what had happened there. And so one of the first things that the first Park Service superintendent, Edward S. Luce, did was to begin an interpretive program and begin hiring people to present the story of that event to the visiting public.
Mm-hmm. There were ceremonies, can continue to be ceremonies, to mark the important benchmarks, the anniversaries at 10 years, 15 years, 20, 25, 30, 50, and so forth. How over time did those things grow in their importance?
Well, they became, let's say originally, I'd say the first noted anniversary was in 1886, and by then that army post was in the area. And so troops came down, and there were observances held at the battlefield. And many of the officers and some of the men who had actually been in the fighting there in 1876 showed up. After that, there was not a great deal of attention until about 1916, the 40th anniversary. And that was a fairly large event with several thousand people in attendance. General Godfrey was there. He had been a lieutenant at the Battle of the Little Bighorn. And several other Indian War veterans showed up. But the really big one was in 1926, of course, the 50th anniversary. And as many as 50,000 people showed up in the span of the 2 to 3 days that the events, planned events, took place there. That was the biggest of all the anniversaries. Thereafter, after 1926, most of the people who were actually in the battle had passed away, and in the 1930s, because of the strictures on travel and during the Depression and even in World War II, those anniversaries were not recognized as intently and did not attract as many visitors. The 75th anniversary in 1951, excuse me, was quite a big event, and at the time the visitor center / museum was under construction, and there were events held at the site, and in 1976 the 100th anniversary took place, but that was pretty much downplayed by the National Park Service because of some fear that some of these Indian activist groups, particularly the American Indian Movement, might, something might lead to violence there. And so there was not a big ceremony in 76, maybe a couple of thousand people there. Hmm.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Jerome Green. He's retired as a research historian for the National Park Service, has authored a number of books about the West, and is author of a recent book that looks at the history of the Little Bighorn Battlefield. It's titled Stricken Field, The Little Bighorn Since 1876. It's published by the University of Oklahoma Press. We have a caller here, and again, others with questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. This caller is in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Maybe this is implied in what you said, but why wasn't this battlefield and bodies completely destroyed by animals and predators and birds and stuff?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question.
Why wasn't the whole remains scene completely dissembled by animals?
Well, to be sure, a lot of them were, from the descriptions that I've seen by people who were on the site. That's exactly what happened. But you're right. The remains were scattered over the battlefield, and they were pulled out of these shallow graves, apparently by wolves and coyotes and other animals that would devour them and leave the bones.
So that was for a long time, and we talked about this a little bit earlier. I think that was for a long time a big worry about that was the condition of the remains that were there.
There was one man that, when he found out that the government was mounting a campaign or an expedition to retrieve the officer remains. He was the father of an enlisted man who died with Custer on the ridge, and his name was Staples, and he lived in Massachusetts, and he was so angered by the fact that the government tried to very subtly mount this campaign to retrieve the officer remains without doing anything about the enlisted remains, that he wrote his congressman, and his congressman passed the information on to General Sheridan. And in the long run, I believe it was this citizen, Mr. Staples, Samuel Staples of Massachusetts, who actually had a big role to play in the dedication of that site as a national cemetery in 1879.
So you were talking about the fact that after the relatively soon after the battle, further U.S. troops arrived, and what they did was that the remains that they found, they buried them where they found them, and then later they were moved and tried to get them all together. Did the Indian people, did they then also go after the battle? Did they remove the bodies of Indian warriors that had been killed?
Yes, that is why it's so difficult to arrive at any consensus on the number of Indian casualties, particularly fatalities, at Little Bighorn, because the Indians customarily removed their people from the site. Now, there were some funereal lodges in the area of the village where the village had stood, and when these people moved all their teepees out on the afternoon of June 26, after another day had passed, and they'd been fighting Reno's men, we haven't talked at all about Reno's men down 3 miles away, those men largely survived. Reno had about 43 casualties, fatalities down there with his command. But after the Indians removed their village and headed south when they realized that General Terry and Colonel Gibbon were moving south up the Little Bighorn Valley, the they put some of their dead in these funeral lodges, and they were seen by the troops when they arrived. But that really isn't a complete picture of the number of Indian dead, and so that's always been a question mark. And based on Indian accounts, it seems like fewer than 100 Indians were killed at the Little Bighorn.
If you look at, I'm particularly curious about the ceremonies that that mark the anniversaries, the various anniversaries for those that occurred, say, up until the 30s, when there would have been survivors on both sides of this conflict still alive. What kind of participation was there by Indian people in this event? Because I know that indeed there were at various points Indians in attendance, some of them who I believe actually did fight at the battle.
Yes, and you know, it's too bad that the Indian people were not more profusely represented at these ceremonies. They were usually invited almost as an afterthought. Let's bring some Indians in, you know, to add color to these ceremonies. There were groups of Crows, of course. The Little Bighorn is really an enclave within the Crow Indian Reservation. And the Northern Cheyenne Reservation is just east of it. It abuts the east end of the Crow Reservation. So those two tribes are usually better represented, say, than some of the other groups, particularly the Lakota Sioux from South Dakota. Although in 1926 there were Lakota Sioux there, and one of the principals was Chief Joseph White Bull, who was in fact a participant in the Battle of the Little Bighorn as a very young man. He was a nephew of Sitting Bull, who was the Hunkpapa medicine man and chief of the Lakotas, of the Hunkpapa Sioux.
It seems that, to me, I think maybe one of the most interesting aspects of this, maybe it's because it's the controversial aspect, is how it is the perspective of the Indians is represented at the site and how it has been.
Well, the big development up at Little Bighorn that really transcends the decades, I believe, and the most important thing to happen there since the battle is the inclusiveness that's now apparent with the erection there of the Indian Memorial in 2003. And prior to that, in the old days, certainly the view was that the Indians were part of the story, but they were not the focus of the interpretation there. And it was originally, it was all Custer, and people were very interested in that aspect. Many of the Indian people did not even go to the battlefield because they felt that they weren't a part of that story. They were not represented. There was nothing really for them to do to when they went there. But gradually through the years, that's changed. I'd say beginning in the late 50s through the 60s, 70s, and quite frankly, I think Russell Means and AIM deserve a big part of the share of the compliments for what they did, because I think they brought this about by some of the stands that they made up at Little Bighorn themselves.
Mm-hmm. So that seems, maybe we shouldn't be surprised, but it does seem remarkable that here we have a battle that takes place in 1876. The monument that still stands there to the 7th Cavalry who died was set up in 1881, that it wasn't until 2003 that the Indian Memorial was set up.
Exactly. It's, but that's just the way our society has dealt with this matter. I think another important addition was the book "Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee." Most historians, including myself, do not think highly in terms of its factual content and its objectivity. But nonetheless, that was a very thought-provoking social document that really, for the first time, made Indian Americans apparent to the average white American around the country, or non-Indian American, I should say. And it had a catalyst effect on what happened at Little Bighorn, and together with the work of some of the Indian activist groups, it brought about a change in view, and also I think as populations moved around the country and some of these reservation communities, which at one time were isolated and remote, they became more and more people moved around them. Populations grew and populations became much more aware and sensitized to other people in the area. So I think there's been a big shift in favor of inclusion of the Indian recollections of what happened there. Certainly Indian accounts of the Little Bighorn are very important in terms of our figuring out what happened, particularly at the Custer end of the field, because his battalion was completely wiped out.
And there are now some markers have been placed to mark where Indian warriors fell. How did they, you know, given all the difficulties in knowing what happened, how did they even establish where some of these markers would be placed?
Well, a lot of that was the work of individual Indian families that who went up to the area and who marked what they call little rock cairns on the field where members of their family fell. That program has been underway. Well, the first marker for an Indian was put in 1958 when John Stanzentimber, the Northern Cheyenne historian, pointed out the place where this individual had fallen in the fighting, and it's kind of grown from that point. Although there was a long hiatus before the 1990s, when the current historian up at the park, John Dorner, instituted a program of actually putting in red marble markers or red granite markers for Indians who we can determine with some precision fell in the fighting. I think that the rock cairns are helpful, but it would be nice if we had further evidence for some of these, and I fear that maybe some are being put in without the adequate research basis.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Just to remind people who are listening, our guest is Jerome Green. He is retired as research historian for the National Park Service, has written some number of books about the West of this time. He's also authored a recently published book that's titled Stricken Field, The Little Bighorn Since 1876. It's published by the University of Oklahoma Press and does indeed look at the, not so much at the battle, although as I mentioned, there is a section of the book that talks about the battle itself. Really the focus of the book is what has happened to this battlefield since, ever after. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Was there controversy surrounding adding the Reno-Benteen site in?
Well, not so much controversy of adding it. Mrs. Custer, now this came about in the 1920s, shortly after the 50th anniversary in 1926, there was interest by the state of Montana to enclose that area and to represent it as part of the battlefield. It certainly was part of the battlefield, and the Custer end of the field, as I explained, was just the end of the battle. A big part of the engagement occurred down there 3.5 to 4 miles away, where Reno's Major Marcus Reno and Captain Frederick Benteen, their two battalions were holed up on the bluffs after Reno had been chased out of the valley trying to attack the south end of the village. And in 1928, the state of Montana passed a memorial to the U.S. Congress to establish boundaries around an area that could be used to represent and to interpret that part of the battle. That finally came about in 1929 when a stone memorial was placed up there, and the War Department managed to get 160 acres of land withdrawn from the Crow land, and that constituted what is now called the Reno-Benteen Defense Site, which is a major part of the interpretation. And as I explained, it's really the beginning of the action. So it's very convoluted as you try to understand this battle when you visit the site, because you really need to go down to that particular area and then move north to the last stand area. Now, the controversy about the Reno-Benteen area was that Mrs. Custer felt that Reno had been had not gone to the aid of her husband, and that he was a coward, and that he didn't do his duty, and she didn't want his name on the memorial, and so to this day, it's not on the memorial.
Yeah, and he was one of those, one of the 7th Cavalry that actually did survive the battle. Everyone wasn't killed.
Yes, Reno. Oddly enough, Reno in 1967, one of his descendants decided to get Reno's remains. Well, Reno was dishonorably discharged from the Army, and this relative in the 1960s got his honorable discharge reinstated, and that paved the way for his reburial in, of all places, that cemetery at Little Bighorn, which is probably the last place on earth that Reno would want to be.
Yeah, well, that probably would be the last, also the last place that Mrs. Custer would want Reno to be, too, I suppose.
You know, Mrs. Custer never visited the site.
I thought that was interesting. She never went there.
She never went there. She couldn't bring herself to visit the place where her husband died. She was very devoted to him, and probably was his greatest champion. She outlived him by 53 years, dying in 1933 at age 91, I believe.
Well, did she have an important role all those years in determining how it is that people thought about the battle?
Yes, very much so. And this was parlayed in a number of books that she wrote about him, Boots and Saddles, Following the Guidon, Tenting on the Plains. They all championed her husband's role in the so-called development of the West. And throughout the remainder of her life, people did not speak out against Custer at all, or largely because of respect for her. And so it was only after she passed away that the first really critical, and I mean critical, biography of Custer appeared, by a man named Frederick Van de Water, and it was called, of all things, Glory Hunter.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have several callers here. We have a couple of minutes left, and we'll try to get in as many as we can, starting with someone in Crete on our line number 4, toll-free line. Hello?
I might mention that Dee Brown was a librarian there where you are at Champaign-Urbana, University of Illinois.
Yes.
I just wondered if you would talk a bit about the transition of Custer as a character from Earl Flynn to Mulligan in Little Big Man.
I can't hear.
The character of Custer has changed somewhat from the 1930 version with Earl Flynn, 1940s, the guy with the boots on, to Little Big Man, who made him a madman. And if there were three books on the Bighorn Battle that you would recommend, would Bob Utley be one of them?
Oh, most certainly. Yes. Utley did a wonderful book, visitor guide, in fact, that's for sale at the battlefield, that would be a great place for anybody to start to read his book about his guidebook to Little Bighorn Battlefield National Monument. If you want two more books?
Yeah, give me two.
I would say Custer's Luck by Edgar I. Stewart. That book appeared in 1955, but it's it's still, I think, the best professional synthesis of data related to the Battle of the Little Bighorn.
One more.
I would say John Gray's book on the Centennial Campaign, which also kind of gives a more than an overview, a very detailed accounting of the campaign against the Sioux in 1876.
Where would you come down with the characterization of Custer, the more the Earl Flynn or the Richard Mulligan?
Well, somewhere in between. I mean, those are really too broad. That's quite an extreme there. But you're right. The Errol Flynn that appeared and they died with their boots on represented the view of Custer at the outset of World War II. Mulligan what was the name of the movie?
It was Little Big Man.
Little Big Man really represented the view of the kind of the anti-establishment view that aligns with the period of the Vietnam War.
Thank you very much.
All right, over to someone in Belgium, line one. Hello?
Yes, interesting. If I remember right, the nearest town to that is Sheridan, Wyoming. And very interesting town. I mean, large town. There's smaller towns nearby.
Well, it's actually situated between two kind of major cities. Sheridan, Wyoming, about 74 miles to the south, just across the Wyoming line. And then to the north, about 65, 67 miles away, is Billings, Montana. Now, there are a couple of towns in between, like Hardin, which I'm sure you've heard of. And right there below the battlefield itself, about 3 miles distant, is Crow Agency, which is the headquarters of the Crow Indian Reservation.
That gets to the actual question I was going to have. I find it very interesting that this battlefield and National Monument is actually located on Indian Reservation.
Well, that's where it happened. The Crows were given that land in 1868, and it was quite a broad track, and they relocated their agency headquarters to what's now Crow Agency in the early 1880s. As the National Cemetery was set up, it was designated in 1879, but there were no meets and bounds arranged or assigned until 1886, until under Grover Cleveland, and the Crows were compensated for the taking of that land, but they weren't paid off until the 1930s, of all things.
That sounds very typical, doesn't it?
Yes.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Let's go next to someone calling on a cell phone from somewhere near Aurora. Hello, line two.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was interested in the aspect of, you talked about Custer's wife never going to the battlefield. Didn't she also lose a brother-in-law in this battle? And didn't Custer lose several relatives in the battle as well?
Yes.
I have one more observation. The Rock Island Arsenal in Rock Island, Illinois, has a small area dedicated to this conflict, and I was wondering if you've been there and if you have any comment as to its authenticity or as to its significance. And I'll hang up and listen.
Okay.
Well, that's interesting. No, I have no idea about that place at Rock Island that's dedicated to the Battle of the Little Bighorn. Next time I go through there, I'll be aware of it, and thank you for that information. Now, as to the people who, the family who died with Custer, it included not only Lieutenant Colonel George Armstrong Custer, but his brother Tom. Tom Custer commanded Company C of the 7th Cavalry at the Little Bighorn. It also included another brother, Boston Custer, who was a civilian and who was just kind of along as on a summer lark in 1876. And Custer's nephew, Audie Reed, also died, as well as his brother-in-law, James Calhoun, who was married to Custer's sister, Margaret. So, indeed, it was a family affair of sorts.
We are going to have to stop, and I'm really sorry that I have one more caller we can't take, but we've just come to the end of the time. And again, just I would suggest if you're interested in reading some more about the Little Bighorn battlefield and what happened there and how people have thought about it and what has been done with it since the battle, you can look for the book that I've mentioned, Stricken Field, The Little Bighorn Since 1876. It's published by the University of Oklahoma Press by our guest, Jerome Green. He's retired as researcher historian for the National Park Service. Mr. Green, thanks very much.
Thank you very much, David.
WILO programming is made possible by the Center for Advanced Study, whose Millercom 2008 series presents Shakespeare as a Sky Watcher, Joining Astronomy with English Literature by David H. Levy on Tuesday, March 25th, 7:30 p.m. at the Beckman Institute. More information available online at www.cas.uiuc.edu. That's it for us on Focus, but we want you to stay tuned. More coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. Celeste Quinn will be with you for the rest of the afternoon, and folks will have the chance to call and ask computer questions in the 1 o'clock hour.
That's right. Peter Kimball will join us following the 1 o'clock news this afternoon to answer our questions about computers. Peter is the Education Program Coordinator and Lead Faculty Trainer for the FAST 3 Consortium at the Center for Teaching Excellence at the University of Illinois. Peter will join us at 1:06 Central Time. Let's take a look at commodity prices now in Kansas City. May wheat, $12 even, down 60. In Chicago, May wheat, $11.31.5, down 60. July, $11.02, down 60. September, $11.40, down 45. May corn, $5.39.25, down 20. July, $5.51.25, down 20. September, $5.53.25, down 20. And December, $5.55, down 20. May soybeans, $13.02.75, down 50. July, $13.18.75, down 50. August, $13.11, down 50. And November, $12.29, down 50. May meal, $3.23.80, down 20. May oil, $58.56, down $2. July, $59.32, down $2. At the Merck in Chicago, April live cattle, 89.82.5, down 67.5. June, 90.10, down 85. March feeder cattle, 99.20, down 10. April, 101.85, down